Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start today in Washington, where this morning White House spokesman Tony Snow was asked about the growing scandal over who knew what when in the White House over last year's firings of U.S. attorneys. He told reporters, "I want to be clear here. Don't be dropping it at the president's door." Well, reporters were asking because the latest batch of emails released by the Justice Department last night indicate that in the weeks before he became Attorney General, then White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez was considering plans to dismiss up to 20% of U.S. attorneys, prompted by questions from White House political adviser Karl Rove. Well, more emails are to be released today, and calls are growing for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to resign. Today, the Boston Globe and St. Petersburg Times became the latest newspapers to urge him to step down. Well, joining us on the line, Mark Halperin, political director for ABC News. In fact, his network broke the story about last night's emails. Mark, it would seem that they seem to contrast with Justice Department officials who testified before Congress that the idea for firing prosecutors came from the Justice Department.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity about the birth of this idea, to paraphrase a famous son of Massachusetts. Failure has a lot of, has no fathers, is an orphan. I've blown the line.
That's okay.
My point is that I don't think anybody wants to take credit for this idea, although you did see yesterday Karl Rove, the president's top political advisor, being very combative and saying there'd be nothing wrong with this. And the fact is, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it is perfectly appropriate for presidents to dismiss U.S. attorneys. Now, the question's going to be not the chronology of whose idea it was, not the question of has the White House been totally accurate and consistent in its chronology that it's given so far, or the Attorney General. I think that the heart of the question is, were the U.S. attorneys who were removed because the White House didn't like the kind of prosecutions they were conducting or not conducting? If that occurred, that's going to be seen by even many Republicans as improper, and we don't know the answer to that yet.
Well, that is, of course, an important element, but if people testified before a hearing in the Senate and were not truthful, isn't that going to be important? I mean, I just want to jump in with the White House spokesman's comments about previous claims that White House counsel Harriet Myers first raised the idea of firing U.S. attorneys. He said today, well, at this juncture, people have hazy memories. Isn't that going to be, if it turns out to be true that, you know, what the testimony was false, that's also going to be important?
Well, I think it's true that there may have been officials who did not speak the truth, but it may be they didn't know the truth or they didn't remember the truth. And I think too much of our politics is based on people being held to standards that just aren't rational, particularly in the post-9/11 era. We can't expect anything less than the best from our government officials, but we also can't expect them to be superhuman. And it's possible that some of these people told what they thought was the truth. Perhaps their colleagues weren't honest with them. Perhaps they didn't have perfect recollections. Perhaps they hadn't seen every document. So I'm not sure that chronology, while important to follow through on, and there certainly continue to be raised because it's improper for executive branch officials to not be truthful with the legislative branch. Again, I go back to the real underlying question here, not whose idea it was,
but
not
why.
Whether their chronology was perfect, but did they engage in what everyone agrees would be improper behavior, the removal of U.S. attorneys for basically political purposes.
Well, what do these new emails tell us about that?
Well, not much. If anything, it would veer you more towards just literally reading the contemporaneous words in some of these emails. It would lead you to believe that they were doing this based on performance and based on their sense of whether the U.S. attorney shared their priorities. Let's say the president looked at the U.S. attorneys, or his people did, and they said, you know what, we care a lot about going after illegal immigrants, or we care a lot about going after pornographers. And they looked at the U.S. attorneys, and some of them weren't doing that. They may have been good prosecutors. They may have otherwise had stellar records. But I think it's generally accepted that presidents can remove U.S. attorneys in that case. But what has been alleged, and certainly what many Democrats and some Republicans suspect, is that the White House was going further than that. It was removing people who weren't doing their political bidding in politically charged prosecutions or lack of prosecutions involving voter fraud cases or corruption or alleged corruption involving people who are up for office in the midst of an election campaign. Mm-hmm. If that occurred, then again, I think it will be potentially illegal. It'll certainly be politically very embarrassing. and damaging to the administration.
Well, we want to grab your thoughts on another topic. Former CIA operative Valerie Plame Wilson testified publicly before Congress today for the first time about being outed as a CIA agent in the scandal that we know took down Vice Presidential Chief of Staff Scooter Libby. Here's just a little of what she had to say.
I love my career because I love my country. I was proud of the serious responsibilities entrusted to me as a CIA covert operations officer, and I was dedicated to this work. It was not common knowledge on the Georgetown cocktail circuit that everyone knew where I worked.
She also clarified, you know, the question many people had. She said she was undercover, in fact, worked in fear that a foreign agent would expose her, and it was an irony that it was the administration who did it, she said, for purely political reasons. Is this resonating, or are we moving so quickly from story to story that, you know, maybe people aren't paying attention?
Well, it is the nature of the times in which we live that anything that's not white hot of the moment tends to be overlooked. And I think a lot of conservatives sort of literally argue that a letter of the law, that she might not have been a so-called covered person by the statute. But it did seem clear that she spent much of her career in a role in which she did worry about her identity being revealed, both for her ability to function as a taxpayer-supported spy, but also for her safety. And even if technically she was no longer covered, I think people should take her at her word that she did worry about that. There's a lot of evidence for that, and I think that has been lost in some of the back and forth. Whether people broke the law in revealing her name, whether people intended to reveal her name knowingly and knowing that it might put her in some jeopardy, whether it would have or not, I think doesn't matter as much as the fact that she did have her life changed, and the taxpayers were cheated out of someone who we'd invested a lot in to be an asset and to be able to work off and on in undercover.
Mark Halperin, political director for ABC News. And by the way, the phrase you were looking for was JFK's success has 1,000 fathers, failure is an orphan.
There you go.
Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we want to spend some time on this Friday with the story of an American family. They happen to be named Sedgwick. The actress Kira Sedgwick is a member. So is Edie Sedgwick, Andy Warhol's tragic muse, the subject of the new movie Factory Girl. But Kira isn't in a book at all, and Edie isn't a big part of it, and that speaks to how rich and complicated this family's history is. Their story begins in Boston in the 1600s. Family members were involved in shaping the country's first government, the first trial in the U.S. that freed a black slave. They helped put down American insurgents during Shay's Rebellion, sat at the head of George Washington's dinner table, produced one of America's first successful women writers, owned the Atlantic Monthly. One was a friend with Alexis de Tocqueville, argued the Amistad case. Another gave Don McLean a room to stay in so he could write the song Starry, Starry Night. And throughout all of it, many of them were stark, raving mad. John Sedgwick's book about his family is called In My Blood, Six Generations of Madness and Desire in an American Family, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start where the book begins, because it begins very powerfully with your own breakdown.
Yeah.
You are trying to figure out whether or not you should jump out a window.
I'd never experienced anything like that, and I hope not to experience it again. But yeah, I was on the top floor of my house, and I was just pacing around like a wild man, and finally just moved towards the window and contemplated jumping out. Fortunately, I didn't come anywhere close to doing that, but it was a terrifying moment
Sure.
for me.
And at that point in your life, you're a successful writer, married, two beautiful children. Mm-hmm. Did you feel in that moment you were playing a role you were destined to play? Did you grow up knowing, boy, we've got this history clanging behind us like a chain of people who've wrestled with mental illness?
I hadn't any clear idea that there was any history of this in my family. It wasn't something that was talked about at length, believe me. There were isolated examples. I mean, everybody knew about Edie's suicide by overdose, and I knew about her two brothers who had died, also suicides. And yet, those were the West Coast Sedgwicks, as we called them, mm-hmm. that we were East Coast Sedgwicks, that we were a long way from there, both geographically and emotionally. That was the thought. But in fact, I learned that it goes back further than that, and it's denser in the family tree than I had imagined.
So you go back, and luckily for you and for us, the Sedgwicks are the greatest letter writers perhaps in American history. The collection of Sedgwick letters here in Massachusetts at the Historical Society is second only to the Adams family.
Yes.
And they wrote everything. And Theodore Sedgwick is the patriarch who would go on to befriend George Washington,
exactly.
who would buy, in probably a slippery land deal, some land through another American from an Indian.
Yes.
and build the beautiful family homestead on it that still exists?
It still stands on Main Street in Stockbridge and is still owned by the family.
And you write about the house and the infamous Sedgwick Pie, which is the graveyard that goes along with it.
Yes. It expresses everything about the family, I would say. It's wonder and dementia both. The way it works is that Theodore and his wife are at the epicenter, and their seven children are in a ring at their feet. And their children are in a ring at their feet, and so on out it goes six generations. So these are concentric circles. I suppose that it looks like a bullseye as seen from the sky. It's so fascinating to me that all the gravestones are pointed in towards their source. Mm. It's so un-American. America is the land of the future. We face out. But this is a group of people, now dead, of course, that are facing in.
Well, and as the joke goes in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, on the day of reckoning, all the Sedgwicks will get up and look at each other.
Exactly. You see, no one but Sedgwicks. That's not a story that the Sedgwicks tell, but and we didn't find it amusing at first, but now we tell it a lot.
I just want to briefly talk about some of the family history that you can hold up. For instance, Theodore Sedgwick played a part in ending slavery in Massachusetts. He took on the case of a remarkable woman. Mm-hmm. We've talked about her on this program before, Mumbet, who
yes.
knocked on his door. She was a slave and literally said, "I want you to represent me. Mm-hmm. I want to be a freed woman." Now, this
yes.
was long before the Civil
Absolutely.
War.
No, she was a woman of enormous courage to do that, because it never occurred to him what the words from the Declaration that were then echoed in the Massachusetts Constitution written by John Adams, that all men are created equal. I don't think it really occurred to him that that meant black people too. He'd had slaves. You know, but I think that he was open to an understanding of the law. If he hadn't had it himself, he was receptive to it from others, even from someone like Mumbet, who is an uneducated black woman. And so, yes, he took her case, and he won it. And afterwards, the former slaveholder that had Mumbet asked her if she would still work for him on a paid basis, and she said, "Certainly not." And then when Theodore Sedgwick asked if she would work for him on a paid basis, she said, "Absolutely."
I'm paraphrasing here, but Mumbet is the woman who said, if I were told that I could have just 1 minute of freedom and I would die afterwards, I'd take that 1 minute of freedom.
Absolutely.
She's an extraordinary woman and became a part of your family history.
Absolutely. She's one of the very, very, very few people who are not Sedgwicks who are buried in the family graveyard. She was a subject of enormous devotion by all of the children that she raised. And we haven't quite gotten to this, but when Theodore's wife, Pamela, started to go mad through a series of depressions, that Mumbet was the only one who could reach her, mm-hmm. that everybody else didn't know how to speak to a woman who was alternately raving or stone silent. And Mumbet was patient and understanding through thick and thin, whether she was lucid or not. I think it's because she knew what suffering was, and so that she could meet Pamela in her suffering as mm-hmm. no one else could.
That's writer John Sedgwick. His book, In My Blood, Six Generations of Madness and Desire in an American Family. When we come back, what Pamela helped him learn about his own mother, decades later, hundreds of years later. That's after a brief break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're talking with John Sedgwick about his family's history of accomplishment and mental illness. One ancestor was a lawyer who represented the black slave Mumbet in the trial that freed her. A cousin, Edie Sedgwick, was the tragic Andy Warhol muse. And we were talking about Pamela Sedgwick. Now, she lived during the American Revolution, was the first Sedgwick recorded with a serious mental illness. John, skip forward to your own beloved mother. Now, she'd been a tennis champion, was in and out of care. You found her papers, including lists. Let me read one. "My probs. I had a bad morning, called the doctor, nervous, trying to throw bad feelings out, no reason to feel depressed, lost confidence." What was it like for you to see the same things appearing in your mom that had appeared in Pamela generations ago?
It was painful, but it was also, I don't know, the word is marvelous. I don't know why, but if it wasn't for what my mother had gone through, I wouldn't have had a clue what Pamela was going through, had gone through. The thing is that depression is eternal. I think that every sufferer feels pretty much the same.
But, you know, reading these, and other letters too, but this is your mother.
No, totally.
Know?
When I discovered this secret trove of diaries in the desk that she had left behind after she died, I really didn't know whether I should open them or not. You know, diaries are private, and yet I had to know. I mean, I didn't resist for very long, and it was a window into her soul, and it was, you know, unfortunately, it was a sad soul that I was seeing, and yet it was her. It was so profoundly her. I was kind of proud of her to be able to set it down and describe just how she was. She couldn't tell anybody, but she could tell her diary. And in telling her diary, of course, she told me.
And she knew that, that you would find, that somebody would find those papers.
Almost without a doubt.
But still, this is your family.
Yeah.
Generations of it. Do you feel at all guilty about telling? You know, there's extraordinary history, but there's also this sad history.
The family has been fine with it. They don't feel that this condemns them or embarrasses them, that this is part of life and that they accept it.
How many, ultimately, through the generations, how many Sedgwicks, you know, they were some of the first patients at McLean's Hospital here and some of the first patients at other psychiatric hospitals in New England.
Yeah.
How many ultimately killed themselves or died from...
Well, I can't give you the full tally, but I can say that in my branch of the family, that it was at least one a generation, and sometimes more. It's a terrible toll, a terrible toll. And not only they're dying, but the way they died, you know, it's just utterly painful for everyone. You know, you wouldn't wish that on anyone. If you read the research on this, you see that the sufferers, the extreme sufferers, are too debilitated by their illness to be able to fully accomplish much. But very often their siblings have a touch of this, but it doesn't register as anything close to full-blown mental illness. But the result is this extraordinary profusion of creativity. And that's what runs through the Sedgwick family and makes it so as distinctive as it is, and the reason why we're talking about it today.
Well, and it's a conclusion that you only come to at the end of the book, and it's a surprise to you that after several turns in your own life that you didn't anticipate, including a divorce.
Right.
You now have to grapple with, me too.
Yes.
I thought I was the researcher and I'm the researched.
Well, exactly. What a shock that was. It's a miserable disease, extremely difficult. And one of the hallmarks of it is that you don't recognize it for what it is. That when someone tells you you are this, you resist. You think it's just part of your personality. It's what makes you so lovable.
And let's describe it in the way that you suffered or lived it in either case. Wonderful highs, just tremendous spirit, and
devastating lows. On the high side, there's this this unwarranted exuberance. You're the happiest man on the planet, talking to everyone very freely. More ideas are flying through your head than you'd ever had before. You are walking on water, or you're 10 feet in the air. And while you're having a delightful time, you're a total pain to other people. And then on the downside, of course, you're massively depressed and unable to function. How does that sound?
Like a terrible combination, but as you write, if you think about a lot of the people that, you know, they almost become like human fireworks.
Yes.
You know, and a lot of the people who are so successful, maybe this is tolerated because, look at the light they're casting.
Well, exactly.
Until
what a lovely light.
Well, and you come to the conclusion that more than the house, more than the graveyard, the manic depression is one of the driving forces in the family.
I think it is. Not for everyone, and certainly everyone in the family would not agree with this, but I feel that it is definitely a dynamo, yes. If this book accomplishes anything, I would hope that it reassures other people who have this in their families or in themselves. That one of the blessings of looking back in the past and seeing other sufferers who've gone before is that you realize this is something you've inherited. It's part of your legacy. It's part of what makes you who you are. And it goes along with the family name or your intelligence or your height or the color of your eyes. All of these things are received. And the question, of course, is what you do with them. So that the fact that one person or another is a sufferer from this disease, which is entirely genetic, it allows them to ease off a little on the self-persecution.
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioned you did the writing for others to read it today, but it seems also maybe to tell the stories that couldn't be told back then by generations of people.
Yes, I was telling their stories, but really the whole effort was to understand my father. He had died when I was quite young. He was a man who was born in 1899. He was a creature out of the 19th century. He was also somebody who loved family history and lived family history. He had the inscription from Mum Bet's gravestone in his wallet. He knew third cousins 17 times removed, all of that. I didn't, and I got to understand that and learn about that through this book, and through doing that, got to understand him really for the first time.
John Sedgwick, his book is In My Blood, Six Generations of Madness and Desire in an American Family. And on a much lighter note, I just wanted to comment that all I could think of was, as we mentioned, Kira Sedgwick. Mm-hmm. Is your cousin second?
She's my niece.
Niece.
Incredibly.
Married to Kevin Bacon, and Kevin Bacon thinks he's got 6 degrees of everything. He's got nothing on the Sedgwick family. They have, you know, he's just in their game.
Exactly.
John, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Okay, stay with us. Much more after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're going to spend a few minutes now talking about coal and global warming. Okay, if your eyes are glazing over, think about this. Coal plants produce more than 50% of the electricity we use to turn on the lights or power the microwave, and dozens of new coal-fired power plants are being built, adding to the existing plants, which produce the greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming. So what to do? Well, this week, MIT released a study that says the best thing to do, and quickly, is to capture emissions from coal-fired power plants and seal them thousands of feet underground. The process is called sequestration, and it's much in the news this week. Reporter Matt Wald covers energy issues for the New York Times. Matt, you read about a company that's going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to do just this. What's the company, and what are they going to do?
It's American Electric Power, which is one of the largest coal users in the United States. They're going to try out one method of separation and sequestration at a plant in Ohio and in another in Oklahoma. And they're going to do some lab scale tests on a second method, because you've got to do this on a huge scale, and nobody has yet succeeded in doing it on a utility scale. It's laboratory experiments, MIT is saying, have to be made to work on a huge volume.
And of course, that had us wondering, do we know what that's going to do to the Earth if all of these emissions are, you know, shot down into the Earth? For instance, if it leaks out, could it hurt farmland? Do we even know?
The risk of leakage is just that you've wasted a terrific amount of time, effort, and money, and even some carbon. You've got to produce carbon dioxide to get the energy to store carbon dioxide.
Right.
It's not likely to be a threat to human health or to animal health. But on the other hand, we don't have much experience pumping things that far down and being sure that they'll stay put.
And as you write, there are plants that are using forms of this technology, this capturing and storing, or in this case, capturing and selling food-grade carbon dioxide, which is used in carbonated beverages. I mean,
it's got to come from somewhere.
Well, I mean, you know, the images of this, you know, horrible coal plant emissions, then you drink them.
It's sequestered until you pop open the can of soda. No, actually, it goes through a chemical process. Food grade means it's at a high level of purity. It's also used for things like flash freezing. You take the liquid carbon dioxide, you expose it to food and let it flash to a gas, and that absorbs so much energy, your chicken or your vegetable or whatever is instantly frozen.
Right. Well, you said how huge a project this is, and we said that MIT has an urgent note to its study saying that this has to happen fast. What's the thinking about how much of global warming could be prevented if coal-fired companies do the sequestration?
The problem is it's not only the United States. It literally is a global problem. It doesn't matter where in the world you emit these gases. And at the moment, our output is still rising. Most output is still rising. China and India is still rising. They're not going to go for any limitation scheme until anybody else does, and until it's been demonstrated to work at a modest price. So we've got to get our act together and show the world how to do this. We've always been the technological innovators in this area. We've got particular problems. We've got what used to be the not in my backyard syndrome now turning into the not under my backyard syndrome. Mm-hmm. We've got to have technical assurance that it's worth it and it'll stay put where we put it. And What MIT is saying is, if you're going to do this at the level of millions of barrels a day of carbon dioxide, you know, something rivaling world production of oil or maybe exceeding world production of oil, we got to build the demonstration plants and show it works.
Well, and at least one environmentalist is saying, don't even wait for that. The Natural Resources Defense Council, in the person of David Hawkins, says that Congress should mandate sequestration right now. Don't wait for the outcome of demonstrations like the one at the Ohio power plant.
That's true, but the utility industry is a little gun-shy, and it was made that way by the nuclear business, where we built a few small reactors. They seemed to work okay, and we immediately set out to build reactors that were 6 or 8 times larger. And we found out as you scale up, it gets complicated, and if you don't know what you're doing, you can waste a lot of money fast. People are not eager to repeat that pattern in trying to sequester carbon dioxide. The other thing we need here is some tax or national cap and trading system or international cap. People will not do a lot of this out of the goodness of their heart, especially if their neighbor isn't doing it at all. This is a competitive business.
And it's an expensive process. Matthew Wald, a reporter for the New York Times, speaking about a move much discussed this week to capture emissions from coal-fired factories and seal them underground to help prevent global warming. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we have some time now to air some of your thoughts. And we heard from a lot of you after our conversation with linguist Jonathan Barnes about right-wing commentator Ann Coulter's comments calling Democratic candidate John Edwards a faggot. Coulter said that was just a schoolyard taunt, to which Jason from Londonderry, Vermont, responds, "When I was a grad student, a friend and I joked at how gay something was. It spun out of a comment about how often we'd use such words as insults all through grade school. Right then, a very dear friend made his presence known by walking away in anger. Heartfelt apologies ensued." These words have been used by children for years, but either Ann Coulter thought she'd hit the shock sweet spot, or she's revealed that she never got over calling people names in the schoolyard. Our story on a trend in colleges toward co-ed dorm rooms, in many cases for gay students who don't want a room with someone of the same sex, it brought back memories for Sandra Meacham Reed of Portland, Oregon, who roomed with a male friend on a purely platonic basis at Berkeley in 1982.
It was one of the most satisfying roommate relationships I ever had. There was absolutely no intergender competition, and I was raised with no brothers, and the kind of the quiet time that you end up talking with roommates gave me a tremendous amount of insight into men.
Staying with the topic of young adults, we recently spoke with author Laura Sessions Stepp about her book Unhooked, which expresses her concern that many young women are foregoing dating to hook up for casual encounters that can include oral sex. Well, listener Emily Savin of Philadelphia writes, "What about the boys? Aren't we past the days of thinking all men are heartless players and all women they're emotionally fragile victims?" While Barbara Gottfried, a faculty member in the Women's Studies program at Boston University, adds, "I'm listening to this report, and it's taken till 3/4 of the way in to make the point that oral sex in hooking up is something girls do to boys. It doesn't involve the sexual pleasuring of the female. Why aren't the investigators, especially when they're women, making this point and try to figure out what it is young women are getting out of this, if anything?" Well, finally, a correction. Our story on franchises yesterday brought this criticism from Vic Kane of Estacada, Oregon.
"You started out talking about Starbucks coffee and switched to some other stories about bankruptcies, suicides, and I was never clear as to why in the world you brought up Starbucks into that situation. They don't even franchise their stores. I just don't understand the connection."
Right, you are, Vic Kane. Starbucks is not a franchise. It only sells licenses when it's forced to by an airport, say, or a college. And a final musical note about our conversation about guilty pleasure music, music you'd die if anyone knew you loved. We now know which of you listen to Celine Dion, Peter Frampton, and Diane Gurian of Intervale, New Hampshire is no longer ashamed to let the world know she loves Supertramp. Congratulate her when you see her. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, a picture recently caught our eye because it was a picture of a flag-draped coffin leaving an airplane as it was carried home from Iraq. Now, you rarely see these reminders of the cost of war. Pictures have been banned from Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, where all the remains of fallen troops first arrive in the U.S. from Iraq. But then it turns out many more make their way home in the cargo holds of commercial flights. And that's where John McSheffrey, Jr. snapped the photographs we saw, and he joins us now in the studio. And John, you're a businessman here in New England. You were on Delta Airlines Flight 1220 from Atlanta to Boston. Your view of that flight was what when you got on it? You know, like same old, same old?
It's another mundane flight. It's something I do every single week, and you want to get on a plane and get home and see the kids as fast as possible before they fall asleep.
Right, and then the pilot made an announcement. What did he say?
He did. You know, it's one of those things that you don't really pay attention to the pilot announcements when you fly so much, but it caught your ear as a different announcement that he was talking about the fact that there was a gentleman on board, a Navy captain, that was escorting home a soldier who had been killed in Iraq. A soldier from New Hampshire, and I didn't catch the soldier's name, and that when we landed, we'd give him a moment to get off the plane first.
What did you think when you heard that, that below you, with your baggage, was...
It was as numbing of a feeling as you can get, and you could really hear the chatter on the plane just almost come to a halt. No one really talked too much. It was very kind of a quiet, somber feeling.
Then how did the people on the plane react to the Navy captain?
It was amazing. The first thing is that when you landed, you saw the sirens outside the window of a color guard formed by the Boston Logan Airport's fire department. And that really caught your eye first. And when we pulled in, the plane opened up the doors, and no one got up. And the Navy captain got up, and we applauded him. And combined between the color guard outside, which he says he very, very rarely sees, and the applause, he started crying. Mm. And when he started crying, so did we. And lo and behold, the whole event was occurring right outside my window as they gracefully tried to get the soldier from the plane.
With a color guard and a fireman from Logan Airport who also...
It was cold out there, too. And those firemen were in full regalia, and those soldiers were there, and they stood there. And the honor that they showed, make me almost cry just thinking about it, was as impressive as you could ever see. And we don't see that. We don't hear it, and we don't see it.
Yeah, and you know, you make the point, and you've said that, you know, what occurred to you at that moment is that in shielding Americans, keeping Americans from seeing these coffins as they arrive in the U.S., that in a funny way the government is keeping families of these fallen soldiers from seeing the reactions of Americans.
It's, you know, it took me a couple of days to organize my thoughts, and I sent out an email to my friends, and that's how it ended up becoming an editorial.
In the Boston Globe.
In the Boston Globe, yes. But since then, the number of families from who have soldiers in Iraq that have reached out to me saying just that sentiment, saying, you know, we feel isolated, we feel like people don't understand our hurt, has been unbelievable. It's been numbing. It's a shame that these families don't get to understand or feel the emotion that normal Americans have for the honor of their sons and daughters. Someone called me, a woman had called me 3 days ago and said, you know, a plane landing in Logan is not full of red conservative folks usually. It's, you know, it's you know, we have that blue state thing going. And she said, you know, the honoring and respecting of that soldier is not a red state, blue state, liberal, conservative. It's a humanistic issue. And every single person on that plane was a human, and every single person on that plane cared and felt the loss of that soldier, no matter what their beliefs were.
Yeah. Well, John McSheffrey, thanks for having the presence of mind, you know, to take the pictures with your cell phone and, you know, let everybody else have that moment of grief along with you. By the way, you missed the name. You don't even know who he was or she was.
I don't. You know, I've had parents from other soldiers call me and write me. And sometimes I hear that phone ring and I get a pit in my stomach going, are they going to call? You're gonna make me cry because, you know, if that family did know how much we cared and how much I saw all these people cry and I saw that Navy captain cry, I saw the firefighters out there in that cold respect that person, they'd understand how much we cared and how much this is happening every single day around our country. And it they need to have some sort of warmth in their heart knowing that they're not alone.
John McSheffrey, Jr. from Needham, Massachusetts, thanks so much.
I'm honored and saddened at the same time. Thank you.
To see his pictures, go to our website, here-now.org. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Auschwitz, Buchenwald, Terezin. The words evoke images of horror, but also transcendent human spirit. A spirit that often took shape in music, often composed by order of Nazi guards, sometimes performed by inmates while rows of prisoners marched off to the gas chambers. Inmates borrowed from popular tunes of the time, but also gave birth to a repertoire of new works that addressed the news, gossip, hunger, and hope of the camps. Lisa Graham is the music director of the Brookline Chorus here in Brookline, Massachusetts. This weekend, they'll perform choral works from that repertoire in a program called Musik macht frei, and she joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
The name of your program, Musik macht frei, or Music Makes You Free, a play on the words that were over the gates of the camps. The Nazis' words were, work makes you free. You've appropriated it.
A lot of the music had double meanings and was performed right in front of the Nazis. And so something like taking a title and changing the name was very much in line with the traditions in the camps. Also, performing music in the camps really did set the spirits free of some of the prisoners and actually saved the lives, literally, of others.
But then there's also the flip side to that, because we understand that these musicians had a higher suicide rate.
Especially in the death camps, musicians were essentially forced by the Nazis to play for their purposes, for their pleasure, for concerts, for instance, or to keep order within the camp. So musicians, I think, felt a double-edged sword. They were literally playing for their lives because they were treated better, because they were musicians. They got more rations of food, etc., but they were also contributing to the really sinister and macabre use of music within the camp.
By the way, there's a slideshow that we've put together with Lisa narrating images of composers and orchestras from the camps. That's at our website, here-now.org. And Lisa, your program focuses on three composers. There's Victor Ullmann, whose composition we heard in the introduction, Hans Krause, and Gideon Klein. We want to hear one of the songs you'll be performing this weekend. This is by Gideon Klein, a Czech composer. We want to listen to Bakri Lian Tisa. The lyric is, "Where are you going, my love? Where are you going?" Tell us more about him and how this was composed.
Gideon Klein was one of the major musical personalities within Terezin. He was actually only 22 years old when he was deported to the camp, and was really a very, very gifted composer, pianist. He also studied philosophy. When he came to the camp, he became involved immediately with the free time activities that were granted, unusually, in Terezin, and teamed with Raphael Schechter to arrange music for the various choruses that existed within the barracks.
Because we should say that Terezin was created by Hitler as a model camp, you know, to sort of mislead the world about conditions in camps.
That's correct.
Many prominent Jewish artists, musicians were sent there, which made for that rich cultural life. But in reality, Terezin was a stopover on the way to Auschwitz. Did the musicians know that? And I'm wondering if that informed their music. Did they know they were on their way somewhere else?
When transports left from the camp to the east, no one really knew where they were going or what was going to happen, except nobody ever came back. And I think there was a certain understanding of that. So that's the bittersweet part of this music, and underscores the tragic death of Gideon Klein at the age of 25.
Some of the other songs, there were protest songs, the Dachau Lied, which was composed by inmate and conductor Herbert Zipper. And inmates also sang from Verdi's Requiem. Was this part of the double entendre?
This was the inspiration of Raphael Schechter in Terezin. He had in mind to perform Verdi's Catholic Mass for the Dead because specifically the fiery poem Dies Irae, Dies Illa, Solvet Seclum in Favilla, which is talking about the day of judgment and how all those will appear before the judge to be judged strictly. And he wanted to sing it to the Nazis and mounted a number of performances. Each time a performance happened or was about to happen, almost all of the chorus was deported to Auschwitz and the gas chambers. And he mounted them again and again. He just kept on tirelessly, relentlessly to build this production from one score.
And he only had one copy.
One copy of the score and one keyboard to try to teach by rote a 100-member chorus who had never sung Latin before. His efforts were amazing.
At your performance this weekend, you'll be directing the Brookline Chorus. Edgar Crasa, unrelated to the composer that you'll be speaking about, Hans Crasa, but a survivor of Terezin, who sang Verdi under conductor Raphael Schechter, is going to be in attendance. He's going to speak about his experience. What has he told you about that?
Edgar Crasa is an incredible inspiration. He and I met because I did a program of music from Terezin at Wellesley College. He called to ask what was going to be on the program, and, naively I said, well, you probably don't know the music. It's, folk songs and things. And he said, yes, but I was there. And that every hair on my body stood up, and I immediately went to meet him, where he told me of his experience as a bunkmate of Raphael Schechter. He sang in Verdi's Requiem, and for him it was a way, for an hour and a half, or however long the rehearsal was, to escape the hard work and the atrocities of the camp. And he can still sing every single word by memory to this day, and goes around and talks about his experience and how it lifted him, essentially, out of the horror of daily life there.
Well, we want to leave you with another recording. This song is Let the Redemption Come Soon. It's performed by the Zamir Chorale with Josh Jacobson conducting. By the way, we'll let you know where they're performing as well this weekend. And this music, perhaps a little more uplifting.
It is. It's a hopeful song, and the words were composed by a survivor who went around to displaced persons' camps to actually try to lift the spirits of them. And it does have a sense of hope and a sense that life goes on. And we're ending our concert with this because truly that is the message of the music and what we are hoping our audience will take away from being there.
Lisa Graham, music director of the Brookline Chorus here in Brookline, Massachusetts. Their program this weekend is called Musik macht frei, commemorating the music of the concentration camps. She's also a faculty member at Wellesley College, where she's director of choral music. Remember, you can see a slideshow with Lisa narrating images of composers and orchestras from the camps at our website, here-now.org. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.